We've seen in the first part of chapter 17 that Ahithophel, the smartest man in all the land, has given his advice that we should go immediately. I'll lead the troops. I'll kill David. I'll bring back everybody else. It won't be some big civil war, drawn out battle. Hushai comes in, the man who's speaking for David, and he says, no, they're like a bear robbed of her cubs. They are trained soldiers. They're bitter. They're angry. David won't even be with the men. There's no way you can even find him. And your men, as soon as casualties begin, will assume that the war is lost and start running and it'll all be over. So what we need to do is gather all Israel together. And once all of Israel has gathered, we'll go out and we'll find him. We'll take ropes and pull down the walls of any city. We'll bring him. We'll kill him. And then the war will be over. And this is the sure way, by sheer numbers, the sure way of destroying David. And they said, well, that advice is better than Ahithophel has given. Ahithophel understands his advice was correct, but can't do anything about it unless Absalom changes his mind. In case he changes his mind, 15 and 16 and 17, Hushai sends the sons of the priests. He tells the priests, and they send their sons, to go warn David not to stay where they are, but to cross the Jordan River. So verse 22 shows them doing that very thing. We were leaving off around verses 19 and 20 when this woman took a covering and spread it over the mouth of a well. And she spread ground grain on it. It looks as though she's drying her grain, and so nobody's going to bother to look under it. And the thing was not known. And in 20, when Absalom's servants came, they said, where are Ahimaaz and Jonathan? And she said, well, they've gone over the water brook. And when they had searched, they couldn't find them, went back to Jerusalem. So, in verse 21, it came to pass after they had departed that they came up out of the well. So these men looking for these two young men have left, and they come up out of the well. They go, they tell King David, who's still on the west side of the Jordan, he needs to be on the other side, that they may come. Here's what Ahithophel has said. Here's what I've said. Now, if they choose, if this fickle Ahithophel, or rather this fickle son of yours, Absalom, changes his mind and comes tonight, or lets this advisor come tonight, you're going to be caught, you're going to be killed. Get over this water immediately. So David, though he's tired and exhausted and discouraged, keeps his travel up. And so in verse 21, after they departed, he tells them to cross the water quickly, because here's what Ahithophel has said. So in verse 22, David and all the people who were with him arose and crossed over the Jordan. By morning light, not one of them was left who had not gone over the Jordan. We need to pause there for just a minute. Now, David receives some very good news. The good news is that if Ahithophel gives his advice again, and this time Absalom takes it, you're going to be slaughtered. That's very good news. Why? Okay, they're not coming right now. What else? He has opportunity to act. He doesn't have to be slaughtered. News can be good even when it sounds horrible. Here's what, some horrible thing this man wants to do with you. This news is very urgent. It's like the parable of Luke 16. The man's about to lose his position as the steward. Sit down quickly. How much you owe? 100? Well, make it 50. How much you owe? 100? Make it 80. And now they'll take him into their houses when he's lost his job. Do it quickly. You have to act quickly. The time here is sensitive. It's time-sensitive information. This is good news because he knows the truth. He knows the facts, and he can be saved. He can take action to get away from this slaughter machine that's coming after him. He has conditions to meet. If he doesn't flee, if he says, well, God will take care of me, I'm just going to stay here, and in the morning I'll look at the birds and listen to them sing, I'll get acquainted with nature, I'll praise God, and I'll be safe. What's wrong with that? God gave him not only a mind and a heart, but also legs to run with. And that's what he needs to do when he's in trouble. And that's what he chooses to do. Now, trust God? Yes. Do words matter? Yes. It's words, the spoken word, that causes these people to know we better cross the Jordan River. Here it's a difference between life and death. And any sacrifice is better than an alternative. The alternative being that the troops will come and they'll destroy you. Now, the gospel is the same way. Is the gospel urgent news? Oh, yes. Acts 2. Save yourselves from this crooked generation. Is it good news? But do you notice in the case of the gospel, it's telling you you are a sinner, you're lost, and if you stay this way, the devil's going to do worse than murdering you. He's going to take you to be with him forever in eternity. You're telling me that's good news? Just as it was with David, if there's a way out of that calamity, that terrible condition. Are there conditions to meet with the gospel? Repent and be baptized? Do you have to trust God to do this? I mean, after all you've done, and all the service you render, are you still trusting God He'll save you? Well, of course you are. And do words matter? Do you learn God's will by means of words, or just sort of an intuition where you feel this way and feel that way and you just think it ought to be some way? No, it's through His written revelation for us. They had it spoken, we have it written. And any sacrifice is better than the alternative. Oh, nobody knows what I've given up in my becoming a Christian and standing for the truth and all that I've had to lose and I can't do what I used to do and the friends I had that I don't have anymore. You think David could have talked about all the consequences as he's running away? I doubt he did. I think he's glad he's going to be spared for another day. And I think we should be glad that no matter what small price we have to pay in bearing our cross, that's just for a temporary thing. We have eternity waiting for us with great blessings. Any comments on that parallel? Or anything else? Okay. In verse 23, they've crossed the Jordan, and when Ahithophel saw that his advice was not followed, he saddled a donkey and arose and went home to his house, to his city. Then he put his household in order and hanged himself and died, and he was buried in his father's tomb. The end, right? No, just the beginning. He's alive now, just not on earth. Ahithophel is publicly disgraced. He's doomed to fall one way or another, depending on who wins this war. But his hatred and his revenge that he's had for David ends in a way that he had not anticipated. When has anybody ever not taken his advice? And had they taken his advice, he would have had his pound of flesh. But as it turns out, someone else had a better plan, or at least these ignoramuses thought so, though my plan was better, he would say. Hatred and revenge always, maybe after a long time, maybe at death, but hatred and revenge always ends in self-destruction. And I think here about Ahithophel, who's disappointed with David and betrays him and ends up hanging himself. And you think of the parallel with Judas, who's disappointed with Jesus and betrays him and hangs himself. And Acts 21 speaks of his terrible appointment that he's made for himself. Now, many people put their house in order, just like Ahithophel did, but destroy their souls in the process. They're really good at putting their house in order, but they don't care a snap about eternity. They make a living, but not a life. David's prayer is more powerful than Ahithophel's mind. And I think that's a lesson in itself. In this society that values the mind of a very, very erudite, learned professor who knows things we'll never know, he's just on a notch or two above the whole human race, a child's prayer is more powerful than that man's mind. And this illustrates that point. Both of these show the impotence of worldly wisdom, whether it's a Judas or an Ahithophel. Okay, comments on that? Steve?
You know, it's interesting. Remember, he said he wanted to go ahead and be the one to kill David himself.
Yes.
The only individual he ended up killing himself.
Oh, good point. Well put. Yes. Any others? Okay. In 24, then David went to Mahanaim. It's about 37 miles north where they would cross the Jordan. Absalom crossed over the Jordan, he and all the men of Israel with him. So this time that it's going to take Absalom to raise this huge army to go after David, that's time that David has to go to Mahanaim, a fortified city, a double-gated city, to be able to prepare his battle plan, organize the army, and be ready. So David not only flees, he finds a fortress that's going to be of inestimable value in case they need it. Now, in verse 25, and Absalom made Amasa captain of the army instead of Joab. This Amasa was the son of a man whose name was Jithra, an Israelite who had gone into Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, sister of Zerah, Joab's mother. So it looks like you're talking about David's half-sisters here, but I've already admitted I don't know a whole lot about that. And then he'll come into play very prominently in chapter 18, by the way. But in verse 26, so Israel and Absalom encamped in the land of Gilead. So that's on the east side of the Jordan, up around the middle and the upper part where those tribes had migrated. And in verse 27, it happened when David had come to Mahanaim that Shobi the son of Nahash from Rabbah of the people of Ammon. He looks as though he's of royal blood, if I read that correctly. Machir the son of Amiel from Lodabar, and Barzillai the Gileadite from Rogalim, brought beds and basins, earthly vessels and wheat, barley and flour, parched grain and beans, lentils, parched seeds, honey and curds, sheep and cheese of the herd, for David and the people who are with him to eat. For they said, the people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness. Now, as you look at this list of things they bring, this is rather incredible. It says they brought beds. And so, can you imagine carrying this great big mattress and frame? Is that what we're talking about with beds here? What are we talking about with beds here?
Something rolled up.
Something rolled up, sort of like a mat that you would unroll and lie on. Now, why is that significant in our study, say, in the passage like Mark 7, when it says they baptize even their beds? If a bed is a mat, I've baptized, I mean, I haven't, but I've seen many a bed baptized, haven't you? Totally immersed. Why is that significant? All right, I'll take the devil's advocate position. I won't be very good at this, but you'll be able to hammer me. Okay, this is now the devil speaking. In Mark 7, we're told the Pharisees wash nearly everything. Not only their hands and their fists and so on, after they've been from the marketplace, but they even wash their pots and their cups, their utensils for the kitchen, and even their beds. Even their beds. Now, we know that a bed can't be immersed. Imagine what a pool that would have to be and how hard that would be to get it out once you had it waterlogged down in the pool. So, there the word for baptize or dip doesn't mean dip. It just means to get it fully wet so as to cleanse it. Okay, I'm through. What are you going to say? Well, it's not worthy of a response.
Dump that pretty easily. You're not talking about a large mattress. You're talking about something that can be dipped in a small area and drawn back up easily.
So you're saying it's a cultural thing for us to think of a bed in one way and they thought of something totally different.
Exactly.
Totally right. You remember Mark 2? Those men are carrying this guy on a pallet, on a bed. And when he's through, what does this guy who's been healed do? He picks up his bed and walks away. Now, if that's our kind of bed, he not only was healed, he was made a Superman. Imagine tucking that thing under one arm, and he was a giant too. Obviously, that's just a misuse of the term bed, and we have to let their terms mean what it meant to the ones who received it originally, not impose our definition of bed on the usage they knew was there. Okay, Greg?
Yeah, it is not hard, and we still use the terminology. Those of us in the military, we carried our beds with us everywhere, right on our back.
On your back, yes,
and
yes.
And camping, you roll it up and put it in a stuff sack. So it's not very difficult to understand.
Which is why I would assume no soldier could be an effusionist, a sprinkling believer, because he knows the use of the word bed. Not on that passage, at least. Matt?
All that argument would do, if it were right, would be to prove that but it still doesn't answer the passage. It's like Roman 7.
Yeah, to be buried. It wouldn't explain that away at all. So that's another good answer. Any others? Okay, good job. Now, furthermore, you look at this passage and it says, these are men, friends of David, who said, the people are hungry and weary and thirsty. Oh, that's so sad. And we wring our hands, but we don't do anything. No, that's a fair weather kind of friend. This is a true friend who do something about the need, like in James 2. A brother or sister is naked and in need of daily food, and you say, oh, I hope you get food, and I hope you're warmed, and I hope you eat enough to be filled. May God bless you, and send them on their way. He says, what kind of faith is that? You've left them as you found them. You haven't changed their situation at all. James 2, 14 to 17. A true faith will act. These men had true faith. In Luke 10, 30, the Samaritan found this man half dead. He didn't say, oh, how sad. I'll pray for you. He did something for him. And you see the same thing in Luke 8, when the women were ministering to Jesus and the disciples, they used to bring contributions to them for them to buy food and other such things. So, yes, God cares for us. We can cast our care upon Him because He cares for us. 1 Peter 5, 7. But sometimes He uses other people to bring about the fulfillment, the answer to those prayers. So, as you look at the friends here, this shows the value of the friends in need and the friends in deed. Now, they bring supplies here that are fit for a king, feasts fit for a king. And it shows us the providence of God in this passage. As you see, God, knowing these people are going to have need of food, clothing, shelter, they bring a number of things to help them. Old friends, such as these who are coming, couldn't go out and grab a sword and fight. They can't help David in that way. This Barzillai is 80 years old. He said, I'm 80 this day. That means that was his birthday, or he means if you want to know how old I am this moment, I'm 80 years old. That was considered old. But he said, while I can't fight, I can do something helpful. What did Napoleon say about how an army travels? Travels on its stomach. I thought I was hearing it all over, but I wasn't sure if I'm just imagining that or if it's being said. Okay, it was being said. It travels on its stomach. So here's an army that needs to travel, and they're giving it some supplies for the stomach. And then I think about 1 Corinthians 12, where each member does its part. In a local church, for example, we have different talents, different resources, different places we are, different opportunities, but the same goal. Just like the various players on a football team have different duties, but all toward the same goal. And we're all united, though different in abilities. Little things mean a lot. A little bit of beans in a can mean a whole lot to a person who is starving out in the wilderness. It didn't have to be a 7-course meal to say, for him to say, that's some of the best food I ever had. Little things also add up to big things. Hushai, for example, Hushai the advisor, Zadok and Abiathar send crucial information. Now, what if they didn't send it because it might make David angry? If we send this information, it might make him angry. Or if we send it, it may make him discouraged and he'll just give up and quit. He can't take that chance. Their job is to let him know what he needs to know, and he can decide from there what he wants to do. Jonathan and Ahimelech carry the information. You know, they had beautiful feet. When a person brings you information that can save your life, you say, those feet that took the trouble to walk all that way to here are beautiful to me. Even on a man. And a servant girl who relayed the messages. What if she'd been too busy? The man in Bahurim who provided the hiding place. His wife who covered the place. The death of Ahithophel because of Hushai. And the threat was ended soon in a permanent way. God will silence every enemy. The friends with their supplies. That's one way that God cares for His people. And I think of Psalm 23. Psalm 23, 5, He prepares a table. Help me with the rest of this. Such a poor memory. He prepares a table for me in the presence of my enemies. You think that would apply here? What are these men bringing? The table, of autonomy, the table standing for its contents. And so, Here's David and all his men. They have this table while their enemies are out to destroy them. And he says, you know, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'm not going to fear any evil. Why? God's with me. I know it because look what my friends just brought me. Guess what? God just sent these men to bring me. And so you can see the Psalms just come to life in passages such as this. Okay, comments on any of this? Dave. Yes.
Then join David, or would he lead with David?
Well, this is Absalom making Amasa the head of the army of Absalom against David. But where I thought you were going is David's going to take that same cousin and make him his commander instead of Joab. Joab is going to be replaced by this man. That wasn't what you're asking, right? Okay.
I wondered if Joab didn't stay or stayed for Absalom, and Joab and Absalom replaced him, and that's why Joab went to join David. Because it doesn't mention him as fleeing with David.
Oh, it's not mentioned in the other text. I take it to be just with the army that leaves. He's with the army. Because I know he's with David and ends up being one of the three chosen to go out against Absalom. Okay, it took me a while to get the question. Sorry. Okay, any others? Okay, we're ready for chapter 18, the civil war itself. You'll notice in 18 verse 1, David numbered the people who are with him and set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them. The word number, you may have a footnote on it that says attended to. It's the idea of review and inspect and muster, and it means all those things. In chapter 24, verse 1, for example, it occurs again when David wrongly takes Joab and he sends him out to number Israel and Judah. So he's the one that is sent in verse 2, but David does the wrong, and Joab strangely says, don't do this. This is not necessary. We have a God who's all-powerful. You don't need to know the number. David says, go number. Go take the number of men who are eligible for battle. It's a census for the purpose of a draft. So to review, to inspect, to muster, as you would muster an army, or to number, all those implied in it. He numbered the people who are with him. He needs to know how many he has, because however many he has, they're not going to be as many as Absalom gets if he brings all the 10 tribes, every available man of the 10 tribes. All throughout Samuel and Kings and Chronicles, all the time when they meet up, it's always the 10 tribes have far more numerically than they do in Judah. But that wasn't the key. It was always who's with God. That was the key. But David has to reckon, what are we going to do with these few who are with us compared to that many who are with them? Well, one thing we can do is we'll put them in three companies. And he takes men, many of whom are battle-hardened. They've been with David in the wilderness. They're veterans of war after war after war. They knew what it was all about. Like him or not, Joab is vicious on the battlefield. He knows what he's doing. Abishai the same, his brother. And then Ittai, the foreigner, who's apparently just as qualified as they are. So those three very qualified men are going to be in charge. So we're told in verse 2, he sent one-third under Joab, one-third under Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, one-third under the hand of Ittai, the Gittite, and the king said to the people, I also will surely go out with you. So notice here, David is provided with security. He has these men who are standing with him. It's not David alone. He has supplies. God has sent people to take care of him. There are three leaders here. They're depending on God. But notice, in depending on God, they use military tactics. They don't say, well, God will save us, so we're going to sit around and just wave our bow at them and we'll be safe. They didn't do that. They fought. They worked at it. They had to do what they had to do. In conquering Jericho, they had to do something, though it was quite easy. In conquering Ai, they had to set an ambush to trick them after they got out. And Judges, Gideon has three companies that rush down on the Midianites. In Judges 19 to 21, the civil war against Benjamin, they had a similar tactic. So tactics and strategy entered into all this. So the old expression is, praise the Lord, but keep your powder dry. They had to praise the Lord and keep your bow tight and be ready for the enemy that's going to come. So in verse 2 there, that's their preparation to get ready. There's no telling what all was involved in that preparation. The latter part of verse 2. The king said to the people, I also will go out with you. But the people answered, you shall not go out. For if we flee away, they will not care about us. Nor if half of us die, will they care about us. But you are worth 10,000 of us now. For you are now more help to us in the city. All right, a few things about this. David thinks he's going to be able to help, provide help with them. They said, no, you can help more by being in the city. Now, David, it seems, has learned his lesson. Where is David in 2 Samuel 11 when the people go out to capture Rabbah? Where does David stay? In his city. What happened to David? His life tanks from that point on. This time, he says, no, I'm going with you to battle. I've learned my lesson, apparently. And they say, no, this time you are going to stay. Absalom's success depends on one thing. It depends on killing one man, David. And if David's dead, these men of David have no reason to fight, unless it's just revenge. And therefore, he has to be protected at any cost. If David dies, the cause is lost. So, David's presence in battle may actually encourage the enemy to try harder. They can say, look at that. I think that's David. Let's go around the back. Go this way. I think we can get him. And all of a sudden, you're concerned as a helper of David with protecting him instead of killing the enemy. Or maybe trying really hard to kill the enemy and they all just swamp you in that one location to get that one man instead of fanning out everywhere because they don't know where he is. And if they don't know where he is, then you have an advantage. Remember another occasion in a very famous battle where an enemy army sought one man only. Fight with no one but this one man alone. I want that one man's hide. You know who that is? Who was that? Ahab, 1 Kings 22. Remember what he got Jehoshaphat to do? Jehoshaphat was a very good man, but he wasn't too sharp. You dress up like me in this battle, okay? Yeah. And they were coming at him, ready to get him, and he screamed out, and they said, oh, that's not Ahab. And a man just drew a bow at a venture and got Ahab. He couldn't outsmart God. But here you have something very similar to that. If David's out there, it's one man thereafter. He may distract men from attacking the enemy to assume some defensive posture to protect David. He puts his men on defensive, like they become secret service agents, not soldiers. He may endanger the men who are trying to shield him from the enemy. There's a famous case in history where Cyrus the Younger was going against his brother because he had harmed him in a couple of ways. And just before they were to go into battle, he forgot to put his helmet on. And they threw a spear, caught him in the eye. Cyrus went down. And immediately his men, thinking he could still be alive, jumped on him and they just filled them full of spears. And they died trying to save him. They couldn't even think about trying to fight someone else. That could prove fatal to men. David wants to stay alive and he'd be the cause of it. It may prove fatal to David, which would encourage Absalom and the rebels, and David's men would have no head. You know, that's pretty bad if you don't have a head. And it shows that war is for young men. If you notice in chapter 21, it records a scene in which the Philistines were at war again with Israel. 21:15. And David and his servants with him went down and fought against the Philistines. And David grew faint. Then Ishbi-Benob, who was one of the sons of the giant, it talks about how big he was and what he was carrying. He thought he could kill David. But at this point, 17, Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, came to his aid and struck the Philistine and killed him. Then the men of David swore to him, saying, you shall not go out more with us to battle, lest you quench the lamp of Israel. So here's Abishai having to protect David instead of just kill the enemy, which is what he's supposed to do as a soldier. So David yields. They tell him he's not to go out. And in verse 4, the king said to them, whatever seems best to you, I will do. So he's able to take advice. He's learning. So the king stood beside the gate, and all the people went out by hundreds and by thousands. And in verse 5, the king had commanded Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, saying, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. All the people heard when the king gave all the captains orders concerning Absalom. Spare the man who led the rebellion. Any of you ever used to listen to Paul Harvey? You remember, he would talk about a certain kind of war you never want to fight. Remember what it's called? A pulled punches war. What is a pulled punches war? That's when you go into a battle, you go into war, say in Vietnam, and you have one arm tied behind your back. We're not going to give you the full force of military might. The war is to kill, but we're going to try to be diplomats and politicians. And so here's a pulled punches war. If you kill the snake by knocking his head off, then the whole snake's going to be dead. That's all you have to do. If they were to do that to David, he would die. But if you leave this head on these troops against David, if you leave Absalom alive, the snake's not dead. And the snake will come back. Now, those are the king's orders. But Joab will ignore them. He will say, I know better than to follow these orders. So in verse 5, deal gently with this young man. He's wanted alive but not dead. And in verse 6, so the people went out into the field of battle against Israel. And the battle was in the woods of Ephraim. The woods are the forest of Ephraim. Now, David, he requests his soldiers deal gently with Absalom, which means he's putting all of them at risk. You dare not shoot an arrow unless you make sure first that's not Absalom. So it slows down the reflection and the reaction time of all of the soldiers. He's ignoring his duty as a judge. He's supposed to punish this man who's worthy of capital punishment, even if it's his son. And if David's not willing, he should leave and just turn it over to Absalom. He's the one who's going to get it if you act this way. Ty? It's okay.
The reason they didn't want him. Are you finished with the topic of the reason they didn't want him to go into battle?
I was, but I'll go back to it.
Can you revisit it for a second?
Yes, sir.
I was curious about, throughout history, the great Alexander the Great was really well known for being the first one over the wall, and military leaders throughout history used to do that, but there was a point in time where that kind of sort of stopped because they realized that maybe wasn't the best thing to have the head guy up there at the front. So would this have been some sort of a trend-setting thing that hadn't maybe happened much prior to David's men telling him, look, you're the lamp of Israel, we don't want you leaving? It seems like that happened even up until the Civil War. The U.S. Civil War, there were still leaders. I mean, the Revolutionary War, the men would stay in line and fire, and then the next line would come forward and load and fire, and not the most strategic
title. I know. Well, you're right. It's been true off and on through history. Washington and some others learned from the Indians, you just don't do that. There's a whole lot better way to fight than standing out there beside one another and say, well, I hope it's not me. Alexander had wounds literally all over his body, they say, for being the first one over the wall. That's just very common. And on and on. But there are occasions where men, because they were so old, could not, and yet the fellows in the battle thought enough of their leadership, they wanted them there, though they were no longer able to lead. If you were a Spartan, Leonidas and the others, they're among the first to die. First in battle, last to leave, and they wanted to make absolutely sure that they don't go home the only man who survives. And two of them survived Thermopylae, and both of them killed themselves because they couldn't live with the shame of not having died. We must not have done something right. And it goes on and on like that. But at what point in history you have kings like this in Israel, I don't know. Because even in the Maccabean period, you have the leaders, as long as they're able to, going out with their troops, even at a rather advanced age sometimes, going out with their troops. You have a Moses who, in Exodus 17, is holding his arm up, watching the battle below, and Aaron and Hur holding his arm up, helping him hold that rod. And as long as he's holding it up, Israel wins. As long, if he slumpers down, the Amalekites win. And so you have him involved in that way, but he's not on the battlefield. So I think it's a mixed bag all over. I don't have any definite answer, as you can tell, by the way I've rambled all over creation. Okay, Dave had his hand up.
Do you think 21 is chronological in order?
21 happened before this, so this is the reason why his men are saying...
Oh, chapter 21? It's possible. Possible, because it's not always chronologically outlined, but I don't know for sure. I don't know for sure. He's even older. The fact that it says again, the Philistines attacked again, makes me think it may not be, but I don't know. I don't know. Tim?
Hushai anticipated this, because he told Absalom David would be with him.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, the wild goose chase he sent him on had enough truth in it to be believable, and it he'd have to say, yeah, he was telling me the truth. Okay, any others? Well, verse 6, the people went out into the field of battle. The woods of Ephraim, also known as the forest of Ephraim, is an enigma to me in some ways because Ephraim is on the west side of the Jordan. And these men are fighting on the east side of the Jordan. And so you notice here in verse 7, the people of Israel, and remember now, they've crossed the Jordan. The people of Israel were overthrown there before the servants of David. The great slaughter of 20,000 took place there that day. And it says the battle there was scattered over the face of the whole countryside, and the woods devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. The word devoured there is eat. The woods were eating men alive, is what that's saying. Now, if you talk about Mahanaim, this is a little bit far to the east in my opinion, but that's the general area where they were. Here's the forest of Ephraim. As best anybody can tell. Here's Ephraim, the tribe allotment. Here's my suggestion, and take it for what it's worth, maybe a negative one cent, I don't know. There is forest work in this tribe, and let me see a passage here that talks about it. Joshua 17, let me get there very quickly. The clock is hurting us. Joshua 17, starting at verse 15. This is Ephraim and Manasseh talking to Joshua. And he says, if you're a great people, go up to the forest country and clear a place for yourself there in the land of the Perizzites and the giants, since the mountains of Ephraim are too confined for you. But the children of Joseph said, the mountain country is not enough for us. And all the Canaanites who dwell in the land of the valley have chariots of iron, both those who are of Bethshean and its towns and those who are of the valley of Jezreel. And Joshua spoke to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh, saying, you are a great people and have great power. You shall not have only one lot, but the mountain country will be yours. Listen to this. Although it is wooded. Is there a wooded area, a forest of Ephraim that they conquered? Absolutely. You shall cut it down, and its farthest extent shall be yours, and you shall drive out the Canaanites, though they have iron chariots and are strong. So, is it possible that what happened in the natural geographical characteristics of this land, that you have this forest that just continues across the Jordan over to this area too, and that for that reason it's still called the forest of Ephraim? I don't know. Is it possible that when in the days of Jephthah, the Ephraimites, remember they couldn't say Shibboleth, they said Sibboleth, there a lot of those are killed in this area? Could it be that it's called their woods because that's their slaughter place? I don't know. But it's pretty clear, and we see it later in this same chapter. They've crossed the Jordan, see the area, they've crossed the Jordan. Not long after, we don't know exactly how long Absalom came to, there's Mahanaim. See, that's a little bit better than it was way over there. And you have this forest up here, a mountainous terrain here, perfect for David and his men, but not for those who come and they're new to the area. Any comments before we close? Best I can do. Thank you very much for your help tonight.